Hey, in this interview, I talk with Akshar Patel, the founder of The Emissary, a blog and now YouTube channel focused on all things India, from politics to culture. It's one of the most educational sources I've ever found on the topic of trying to understand India, which is increasingly relevant. And what I ask Akshar about is, why aren't the US and India better allies? Who is India's primary adversary? Is it Pakistan, who they've gone to four wars with in the last century, or China, the rising power in the East that with which India also has border disputes and histories of other rivalries in the past? Akshar is really thoughtful. We also talk a little bit about Modi in the context of other world leaders, and overall just going to be a real eye-opening conversation as it pertains to India. I think you'll learn a lot from it. Here is Akshar Patel.
So Akshar, it's really nice to be speaking with you. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Aaron. Happy to be here.
So I want to start off with a big question. Why aren't the United States and India closer allies?
Yeah, I think a lot of Americans have this question. A lot of my friends ask me about this as well. It seems like a natural fit. And I think there's a lot of natural fit elements there. But like every other part of Indian politics, you have to go back into history. So I think the first point of contention is around the independence era. And back then, a lot of Indian founders, they basically believe that, hey, capitalism equals colonialism. And what that meant was that, okay, what are we going to do instead? And it ended up being socialism that they started to go closer to. Fabian socialism especially. And India's first PM, Nehru, he was very fond of this idea. So from the get-go, India and America kind of had a clash on economic ideas. And I think back then, that was really big, you know, communism and Marxism and everything. It was a real ideological fissure. So a lot of India's intellectuals and a lot of their freedom fighters, they didn't really see eye to eye with America at that point. There were some like Ambedkar and Rajaji and kind of Patel. Some of these were more capitalist bent, but they didn't really get into the inner circle of power as much as time went on. It was a lot more socialist people and eventually Marxists who became a lot more powerful within the Indian establishment and the Indian government. So I think that's the first kind of base level of, hey, what's going on here? Over time, this Marxism or this socialism just gets more intense and you start seeing more socialist policies in India. They get closer to the USSR. I think around the same time, if not a bit before, America starts getting close with Pakistan. And obviously, you know, India will get pissed off if someone gets close to Pakistan. So it added more fuel to the fire. But the real breaker, I guess, or the real breaking point would be in 1971. And during this time, Pakistan was divided, West Pakistan, which you could see today, and East Pakistan, which is Bangladesh today. So there was an ethnic rivalry there. West Pakistan had a different group of ethnicities than East Pakistan, which is mostly Bengali people. And also the Bengali people, or these people in East Pakistan, one, they had a high percentage of Hindus who lived there. And secondly, their culture was very, I guess, more Hindu-esque at that point. West Pakistan did like an Islamization campaign a little bit before and even since independence. But East Pakistan, you see a lot of more cultural markers that you would see in India, especially the western part of Bengal, which is in India. It was very indistinguishable on multiple fronts. So with this, I guess there's a justification of ethnic and that, like, you know, religious casus belli, you could say. So the West Pakistani army came into East Pakistan and started, you know, doing military action. There would be rebel groups and they would particularly target the Hindus. Eventually, this became like a genocide. The numbers, I think, are wide estimate. It's like 300,000 versus 3 million. But basically, you start to see, obviously, once Indians see this, they get kind of pissed off since it's a majority Hindu nation. But I think what really made them involved was a huge refugee crisis happened, where a lot of people from East Pakistan, these Bengalis, especially these Hindu Bengalis, they started flooding into India. And India started to have some more economic woes. So at that point, you could see that the Indian government decided to get involved. It was a pretty easy affair overall. I think the war itself went along pretty quickly. India won. East Bangladesh is freed into, or sorry, East Pakistan is freed into Bangladesh. And the Indian government, especially Indira Gandhi and just the Indian military personnel, Indira Gandhi was the PM at that time, the prime minister. They kind of wanted to go with for the jugular, at least elements in the Indian establishment. So they saw that they easily defeated the Pakistani army because it was very stretched out. You know, there's thousands of miles in between West and East Pakistan. They had a bunch of people as prisoners of war, I think around 90,000. So they were in a sweet spot and they decided, hey, let's go finish off, you know, Pakistan occupied Kashmir. Let's go even deeper into Pakistan itself. Let's see if we could capture Lahore. Let's see how deep we could really, you know, get this conflict and maybe solve this problem of ours. Around the same time, American naval ships started to enter, I guess, the Arabian Sea and maybe the Bay of Bengal, but definitely Indian territorial waters are around them in the vicinity of the subcontinent in the Indian Ocean. And I think the Indian government kind of got spooked. And at the same time, USSR or Soviet ships came in. And you see kind of this stalemate happening. So the Indian army kind of stops operations. And at that point, they kind of said, okay, let's sign the peace deal now. They couldn't really go for what they really wanted for that, you know, extra ask. And I think that point, that's really spread in the consciousness of Indians a lot of, hey, the Soviets helped us out when no one else would. And America, as well as various other powers, but especially America, they screwed us over in this, you know, momentous chance of ours.
Contextually there, you know, like from the American viewpoint, you would struggle. I would be shocked if 2% of the U.S. population really knew that history with any sort of fine grade detail. But what you might know from that point in time was that was immediately preceding Nixon opening up China and breaking China away from Russia. So yep. Part of the reason that he wouldn't fully align with India is because he was trying to stay in China's good graces, who was more closely aligned with Pakistan. So there's a lot of moving parts there that gives you empathy for the insane challenge of actually managing these geopolitical conflicts. But it's like one of those things, you know, I keep coming back to like the shorthand of why you probably always get this from American friends. It's like, okay, you know, we're primarily English speaking, you know, tend to be more democratic. Like they had this enormous election, like, you know, now there's that kind of rivalry with China potentially. But you know, it still isn't necessarily as close as some of these other allies we have. And just there's a huge blind spot for this part of the world, knowing the history, knowing the actual geopolitical dynamics, particularly from a Western view. And that's what makes your content so incredibly valuable.
Thanks so much. Yeah. It's, I think you provide great context there. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, that was great. So the other things, like just other kind of stats that are, you know, details that I'd like to explore a little bit more with you. You know, between 1950 and 2000, the U.S. sent about $25 billion worth of aid to India, as much or more than any other entity. So that's like another, back to the shorthand of like American things, like, well, we gave them money, why wouldn't they be aligned with us? But when you kind of nip in the bud, maybe more than nip in the bud, but, you know, limit one of their biggest geopolitical objectives, like those things kind of at least cancel out, if not cause problems for you.
So I think I just covered part one of this story. There's a two and a three, and that aid is three, and we'll get there really quickly. So
yeah.
Part two, basically, things start to upswing after that, actually. I think particularly after the fall of the USSR, you know, early 90s, and then 1991, India committed to capitalism. It was kind of forced to do an economic liberalization by the IMF. So it became a lot more capitalistic. It opened up. And I know America put some sanctions on India in when they did nuclear tests, but Clinton quickly kind of did his own personal touch and kind of mended some ties. At least he started the mend, if we could say. Bush, Obama, and Trump, all three of them, I would say, the ties got better successively and on a pretty steady path. You know, there was a nuclear deal with Bush. Obama, I think generally he just had good relations with India. Even when Modi came, I think he wrote a Time op-ed for him, which is crazy when you think about it now. Well, he's a very polarizing figure, and we could get to him later. But, you know, once Trump came, him and Modi got along very well for whatever reason. So that's part two. And, you know, I think that's where you see a lot of these natural relations happen. You know, India and America, they're very both diverse. They're pluralistic. They're tolerant. They're secular. They're, you know, they're democracies. It's a natural fit. It's the world's oldest and the largest democracy. So you see all of that coming into play. A lot of diaspora came in as well. So many relations. So in part two, you really see, hey, a lot of the plus sides. And I think a lot of trade also, a lot of tech sharing, defense deals, energy. I think everything positive that could have happened, I mean, a lot of it did. Part three, though, and I guess this is the most controversial, and this is the most recent. I think as Biden came, I think, and I don't really blame Biden for this personally, I think he would have been a continuation of a lot of the, you know, general bipartisan sentiment. I think him personally, he probably was towards that. But we know the administration had a bunch of, you know, just rough edges and just a lot of stuff going on in the background. From the Indian point of view, what they see is when Biden first came on the, you know, on the stage, hey, it was pretty good for them. Right before, though, I think Modi may have made a slight mistake. He campaigned with Donald Trump in, I think, Texas. So they did a joint event together with the diaspora. You know, this is in the middle of the election. I think this was 2020. Yeah, 2020. And they did a, I don't know if you could call it a campaign event, but I mean, it was a campaign event, honestly. I think that ticked off a lot of the Democratic establishment. It was definitely a risky calculation that didn't work, but that was a big, you know, I think that might have poisoned some of the well. But even then, I believe when Biden came to power, there was still a lot of people who, you know, generally they saw it as business as usual continue. Maybe a few things might happen, but whatever. I remember when they started appointing people and they started to describe how the relationship is going to be. One of the first things that really started to piss off, sorry, I didn't mean to curse, but one of the things that made a lot of people angry in India was that there was at least one line called subnational diplomacy. Now, India is very, very touchy about separatism. You know, it has a lot of different ethnicities. It's had separatism in the past, and it's very, very sensitive to this. Indians themselves are very sensitive. So this idea of subnational diplomacy, and I think the specific bullet point that was released in a memo was basically like, hey, we're going to engage with chief ministers and Indian civil society. Now, you mentioned that $25 billion that was sent as aid. An idea that has, I guess, spawned in a lot of Indians' minds recently is they don't view aid as a good thing. They view it as, hey, this goes to NGOs, and these NGOs are affiliated with foreign governments, say the State Department or say the CCP, the EU, what have you. And certain activities that they notice happening are, say, I think there's a copper plant in Tamil Nadu in southern India, Sterlite. It was shut down due to a lot of protests and a lot of NGOs were involved in this. This type of stuff happens across India. Usually some type of development tries to happen, NGOs come in, they shut it down, they rile up people, the government might lose votes, so they just stop development. This type of cycle, a lot of Indians are starting to become very turned off towards the idea of aid, especially NGOs themselves. There's a thing called FRCA in India. I don't know what it stands for, what it's called, FRCA. But basically, it is an oversight of this aid coming in, whether it's aid from governments or missionary stuff. And this is another thing that also, you know, pisses a lot of Indians off. They view this stuff coming into India as things that meddle into their internal affairs. And they view this as election interference. And this type of stuff, in Indian people's eyes, it's increased a lot within the Biden administration.
Interesting. That's really helpful context, because it's like, once again, the very simplistic view, it's like there's money coming your way. Like, isn't that a good
thing?
Yeah,
of course.
it's really helpful. So looking at, I guess, then India in the context of this escalating
U.S.-China rivalry. You know, there's potential military flashpoints, there's economic and trade wars. How do they look at that dynamic? Because the other kind of simplistic, you know, reductive view is every time there's a BRICS summit, people will write these headlines of like, they're all conspiring to take down the West and the U.S. is in trouble. And I see that. And like my, you know, superficial understanding is like, you know, it's China and India that have had like border disputes that have actually like turned violent, right? Like it's, I'm not so sure that these are just the best buddies ever, but can you kind of contextualize how India views the escalating U.S.-China rivalry?
I think in, you know, that part two era, especially say Obama and the Trump era, India was completely in America's camp. I think there was a period of trying to have a rapprochement with Xi Jinping. I think Xi was invited to India. Him and Modi did some, you know, photo shoots. They exchanged some ideas. He toured around some temples. So it looked like, hey, there's might be some potential. But I think shortly after, there were some trade disputes. I think TikTok got banned. And around the same time, obviously, there were the Himalayan disputes where, you know, Indian soldiers died, Chinese soldiers died. So that's a whole new level of conflict. And I think now in hindsight, a lot of people's views are China, at least the Indian point of view, is a China was trying to bait Modi into more conflict. Because I might get in trouble in India here, but Indian military, it has issues. It has a lot of back-end issues. It has a lot of issues in the front. There's a internet meme that always gets surprised. Whenever you hear about these border disputes, it's always Indian army got surprised by Chinese, you know, army men who took over a post or something, who started pushing at them. And it's like, okay, why does this army keep getting surprised? It has a lot of issues with reform. There's a lot of corruption in it. And the Indian army stock has gone really down recently. Surprisingly, in a muscular nationalistic government, you wouldn't expect that. But I think a lot of the weaknesses of the army have been laid bare, and it's difficult to criticize it in India. So I think, anyways, that's kind of a tangent. But anyways, I think India was in America's camp at that point pretty solidly. However, you know, as the Biden admin came, and I think it's not just the NGO stuff. I think that's like the stuff underneath that India can probably tolerate. You know, at the end of the day, it's still progressing on stuff like trade deals, you know, tech sharing, immigration stuff. A lot of stuff is going good, even with the Biden admin. There's two real, I guess, again, two breaking points that we see here that really has made India thaw its relationship with China and start to, you know, balance towards it now and try to do, you know, a reset of ties. One is the Indian Lok Sabha elections, which are the parliamentary elections. So that's how, you know, Prime Minister Modi gets elected. And it's basically like a presidential election equivalent. So the BJP won, and most people expected the BJP to win, but they expected it to win with a much bigger, you know, victory margin. And there's various ways you could parse why that didn't happen. Some of them are economic. Some of them are, you know, cultural related, especially caste or region related. But one thing that Indians start to get really wary of is recently, I think on the campaign, the battle was basically between the idea of a centralized India versus a decentralized India. And a decentralized India means, hey, things like caste are more important. Things like regionalism are more important. And a lot of those things kind of threaten, you know, this idea of a united India. And this centralizing idea of India, I think that's a key point of Modi's, you know, regime, or that's what he wants to do. That's one of his goals, to centralize India. So you started to see this right after the election with the tally down. What the BJP started to do is first through lower level people, usually like, you know, two-bit Twitter celebrities and just lower level officials, they would start to blame the US for election interference. And one of the things they would blame them for is these AI videos that start to release, and they would release and inflame tensions around caste, around regionalism. And they would also link this back to things that the opposition members said. And these opposition members, a lot of times they would take trips to the US, And then they would come back and start parodying similar stuff that you'd see in American academia or the New York Times and stuff. So people started to connect dots. And I know I'm getting into like, I don't know, conspiratorial territory here, but this is what people actually believe. Yeah. And I think there's credence to this. And I could go into this later. But anyways, they started to accuse the American government, not through super official channels, but you know, they started to escalate like, hey, these people interfered. This is election interference, XYZ. Once Trump got elected, actually right before Trump, there's the second thing, the kind of 1-2 punch. In Bangladesh, their prime minister, Sheikh Hasina, she ruled, I think, for almost 2 decades or at least a very long time. She was kind of autocratic. They had elections, but she would do autocratic stuff. And I think that pissed off a lot of Bangladeshis. So there's an organic element to this regime change or revolution that happened in Bangladesh. However, again, the Indian government, the way they saw it, is that a lot of this was through stuff like aid or American aid or American interference. And the guy who got who became the caretaker PM, I think his name is Muhammad Yunus. He has connections with, like, you know, the Clinton Global Initiative. He had some pictures with Biden that didn't go so well. They seem really friendly. Just links to American NGOs and just, you know, State Department stuff. This really pissed off India because now an Islamist government came in, who's obviously very, you know, anti-India. Sheikh Hasina was very pro-India. This new government's very anti-India. And you see kind of the similar violence towards Hindus in Bangladesh. And this really has angered a lot of Indians. So these two things, to Indians, this is a culmination of American interference. And ties really, you know, have gone way down. Anyone who's an India watcher, I think for a long time they would deny a lot of these, you know, fraying parts of the relationship. But after these two events, especially the Bangladesh one, a lot of Indians were livid at, you know, America. When Trump got elected, though, this was kind of like the reset. And now you see official channels of the BJP, including the prime minister and the official Twitter handle, talking about this stuff, saying, you know, we're the deep state has done this. The deep state has done interference. They'll do like videos about George Soros and XYZ. So this is like a real thing. They'll accuse the opposition of being in hand with George Soros and XYZ. So it sounds like Alex Jones, like, you know, talk show.
Yeah,
this is real. And you will see even in vernacular, something I got really surprised traveling here, even in vernacular, because the internet has spread everywhere in India. And YouTube is huge in India, YouTube and Instagram video especially. People will speak in Hindi, Bengali, Gujarati, Tamil, all these different Indian languages about these complex geopolitical topics. So even a villager will know who George Soros is or what the deep state is and, you know, this interference angle.
Wow.
So it's really kind of rolled out of control. And a lot of people don't know this. But if you go on ground in India and if you talk to these people, you will see that, hey, it is very widespread now. And that's a problem in the relationship. The good news is, for whatever reason, I remember I saw like a bar chart or a graph recently about people who are very excited for Donald Trump being president. India is at the top and it's like 70% or something crazy. So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen now, but I think the Indian establishment, as well as a lot of Indian elites, they are excited about Trump, but they're very stung by what happened recently. And they want to hedge their bets with China. So even today, I think the Chinese foreign minister and the Indian foreign secretary, they held a meet. And yeah, they are trying to, I guess, thaw a lot of ties or mend ties. And I guess the last thing I'll say about this, a lot of Indians, because of the Himalayan clashes, they have animosity towards China, as well as prior wars, but I think this especially, the Himalayan clashes and the actual, you know, soldiers dying and there being this type of conflict, they have animosity towards China. However, recently, I think as they see China's progress, as they see the videos of like Shenzhen or these like crazy cyberpunk montages of like a Chinese city, they see DeepSeek, they see all these progressions by China, there's an element of these people being in awe of China. And I think that's another big thing that's starting to change, where a lot of Indians are starting to second guess things like, not a lot, but it's starting to grow. Some Indians are starting to second guess, hey, is democracy really the best path for India? Is secularism or how we treat our minorities, is that the best path for India? Is X the best path? What about how we view religion? They're starting to look at China and be like, hey, maybe we should start taking inspiration from them versus America. That being said, I think Indians still view America in a very positive light in general. Like, if America offers Indians to come to America, most Indians are going to come. So it's this very complex thing that's becoming even more complex. I think there's kind of, you know, a foot in each side now, more towards America for sure, but there's a thawing that's happening for sure with China.
Got it. Well, that's really helpful context. And I'm not going to ask you to make any sort of forward-looking predictions unless you have anything you feel pretty strongly about. It's really about trying to build the context for people that, you know, this area just remains understudied from my point of view. So I feel like you kind of answered this already, but I think it's an important frame. Does India have a primary geopolitical adversary? It seems like historically it's tended to be Pakistan, but is it China? Is it someone else? Like, how do they think about that?
Now it's definitely China. I think Pakistan in term one of Modi, it definitely was. But as some of the economic agenda that he's done, I guess as India started to lift off, basically, they stopped seeing Pakistan as a real rival. And simultaneously, Pakistan kind of unraveled. And there's obviously skirmishes in Kashmir, and that's still a sore spot. But I have noticed a lot of Indians, they're thinking about India not necessarily as a foil to Pakistan or as like a rival of Pakistan, but as, hey, how do we build our country up to be a superpower? And how do we rival China? Because China is the one who is definitely going to threaten us. And like I said, I think a lot of people, whether the government or people in general, they're kind of afraid about the military's capability versus China, especially now that China's technology sector, that's definitely coupled with their defense sector, it's just skyrocketing. What is India going to do, you know, when that comes? What is India going to do against China's drone technology or whatever they field in the Himalayas or anything they do, really? Can it compete? There's definitely a worry of Indians when it comes to that, but there's a simultaneous ambition that, hey, you know, we need to step our shit up, essentially. We need to get better, and we need to start looking at China eye to eye instead of being, you know, way below them.
I know that they've been building, increasing their military budgets. It feels like basically everyone around the world is doing that these days. How do they look at the Quad? Because, you know, once again, that's like another thing, you know, simplistic Western view. It's like, oh, it's another military alliance like NATO or something like that, and will be so powerful because it's India and Japan and Australia and the United States. But very explicitly, it was India who pumped the brakes and said, this is not a full-on alliance with, you know, you get attacked, I have to fight. It's much more of a platform cooperation. We'll do some exercises together, but we're not going to go all the way up to that line of being completely and totally aligned with you.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter too much, but I saw a tweet today of this guy I follow, Indian guy, he's very smart. And he was kind of talking about this, not necessarily the Quad. I think India was very, you know, gung-ho about the Quad earlier. But as these relations starting to change, one thing he tweeted was, hey, India is not trying to be the Asian Ukraine, essentially. They don't want to get dragged into a fight with China that they know they are going to lose. Indians are not confident about fighting China. They're somewhat confident about defending their territory, but going into China is another thing. Sending people to Taiwan is another thing. I think Indians are really focused on, let's grow our capabilities, let's grow our economy, let's grow our defense, but we do not want to fight the Chinese people. It seems like there is partially, and it is kind of an admission, I don't know if we could say admission of defeat, but it's an admission of, we are not good enough to stand up to China, and we don't want to, you know, antagonize these people a lot. I remember recently, I think last year, Pelosi or someone high visited Ladakh, like some of the Tibetan people. And in general, Indians are pretty pro-Tibet, like because of also religious ties, like Buddhism and everything, and just generally good views towards Tibet. But a lot of Indians were kind of spooked by it. It's like, hey, like, why are you visiting these people? Why are you pissing off the Chinese? Are you trying to drag us into something? Like, we like what it is right now. We'll support the Tibetans who live in India, but, you know, anything else, we're not as sure about anymore. So there's an element of fear, honestly, I think, of India or China.
Is there a split, though, between parties? Because, like, you see that, and it's obviously Ukrainian lives more so, but to a great degree more so than American lives, but the perspective of the right versus the left in how involved we should be in something like the Ukraine war, how involved or what side we should take, you know, around what's going on in something like Israel. Is there a split, like, you know, BJP versus INC or some other type of split in terms of people that might be a little bit more like, let's get muscular, let's get a little bit more antagonistic versus those who kind of have a more live and let live pacifistic perspective?
So in general, I'd say overall, there is actually a foreign policy consensus across even the BJP and the INC when it comes to issues like Ukraine or when it comes to issues like Russia, the relationship with Russia. Recently, though, there has been some changes. I think this is more fringe stuff. You know, the BJP accuses Rahul Gandhi, the prime leader of the INC, and I guess the opposition, of being in cahoots with the liberal establishment of America. They accuse other people too, but they especially go for Rahul Gandhi, I guess, because he's the biggest one, and they have a bit more dirt on him as well. I think if you really look down at it, something Rahul does that does not help him is he is a dynast. You know, his father was the PM, his grandmother was the PM, his great-grandfather was the PM. But Rahul, he's like he's not cut out from politics necessarily. I think in a other life, he'd just be doing his own thing. He seems like a kind of chill guy, but at the same time, kind of entitled because he's been pushed into politics. But Rahul, he does not connect with the average Indian. And something he does is he goes to, say, the UK or random places in Europe or America, and he goes to these college campuses and he just talks crap about, you know, India and the Indian government. And he kind of invites pretty much explicitly foreign interference that, hey, America can't stand by while all this stuff is happening in India. You know, you need to put pressure onto the Indian government and XYZ. This type of stuff does not help his brand in terms of being, you know, a strong nationalistic or patriotic leader. And it helps with these accusations from the BJP of, hey, you know, this guy is not India first. This guy is inviting interference and XYZ. But, you know, he has, I think Rahul even himself has been explicit about the Indian position on Ukraine, that India should remain neutral. They should buy gas or oil from Russia. And whatever the BJP's position is, I think he actually agrees with. So there's more consensus than not, actually. The breaking consensus is, again, a lot of this civil service stuff. How are we going to interface with these NGOs? How are we going to interface with activists and certain domestic policies as well?
The modern history, at least of India, has been this of general non-alignment, a little bit of swaying back and forth, like you're saying, but never like a hard fastening the way, you know, NATO allies have been really fastened to one another since the early days of the Cold War. Does India have a natural ally, though, that's just kind of all, they're always in the same corner, their interests are tightly aligned, or is everyone kind of in that gray zone?
It seems like the most congruent ally has been Russia / the USSR over, I think, since the independence. It has gotten a slightly strained due to, you know, Russia's ties with China and Russia's issues with America. So there's been, you know, slight sparks there. But overall, I think there's a lot of trust with Russia. I think the more interesting allies, though, are these kind of smaller countries that give, I don't know, one or two small really vital things to India. So like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, it's very ironic. Modi, you know, he's called this, you know, muscular Hindu nationalist leader. But overall, like when it comes to a lot of these Muslim countries, India has great relations with like the UAE, Saudi Arabia, a lot of these Gulf nations. They're some of their closest allies now. And they've been very vital in terms of energy. And the ties have just gotten stronger and stronger. Israel is another one. And I think technology is a big, you know, chord here. France for defense. There's a lot of defense relations. And France generally does not interfere with India. I guess it's different from a lot of Anglophone countries. There's not as much lecturing, which India really does not like, especially lately. Japan as well is another one. They do a lot of infrastructure projects. But I've noticed a lot of these small nations, they basically give one or two really important things to India, and India gives them stuff like raw materials, sometimes manpower, in the case of like the UAE or Saudi, even Israel lately. So yeah, I think its best allies are the small countries that don't really pose any, you know, type of threat to it.
It's kind of that conventional, like, trade brings people closer, but there's no like thing to compete over necessarily. Like, I'm not
exactly
quite sure what France and India would compete over. That makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, India conducted the largest democratic election in history last year. Over 800 million, I'm not sure if it was over 900 million, but over 800 million voters. How'd they pull that off? What should we take away about Indian institutions from that more or less going off successfully?
You know, one global trend I notice is that people are losing trust in institutions, I think, in most countries. I know it's definitely true here, like in America. In India, it's not as much. And we could talk about that a bit after. I think, well, one of the reasons they're not losing trust in institutions is, I feel like I'm sounding like such a cheerleader here, but the opposition, it does this thing where it tries to deny the electronic voting machines, the EVMs. And, you know, they've done tests with EVMs that show they work. I don't think they've ever really failed like that. They're kind of low tech, but they're still electronic, so they're very difficult to hack. The opposition has been attacking these EVMs for a long time because the BJP has been winning a lot. I think that's kind of done a counter effect. Like, people are kind of sick of that, and they're just like, whatever, like, we trust this voting process, like, totally. And part of that is due to the infrastructure. One, it's like voter IDs are mandatory. Two, it's phased. So since India has so many people, it's done over time. Three, they keep those results in the ballot box, though, in those EVMs until counting. So, you know, it doesn't really change people's mood as much when they're voting. They don't really see the live counting. And yeah, in general, I think the government, one underrated thing is stability. And Indians really love stability. I think that's a cultural trait of Indians. That's something which a lot of governments in general have delivered. Trade-off there is there's not a lot of dynamic growth as well. But even with the Modi government, they have sacrificed growth for stability. And previous governments as well, I think they've done similar things. So the Indian people have a lot of faith in the political infrastructure and institutions of the government and the Indian state. They may not like things like the bureaucracy and the judiciary, which Indians hate, but, you know, for various reasons, it's very difficult to reform those. But in terms of the Indian political, like, outfit and the government itself, I think there's a lot of faith in how democracy works in general, and just how the democratic process works.
Yeah, it's inspirational when you think of the scale of it. It's like many, many multiples of the size of a U.S. election. And, you know, I'm sure there's going to be you have that many people, there's going to be a conspiracy somewhere. But in general, the fact that it was high trust, we need to find a way in most countries to get back to some degree of trust in our institutions. So I took a lot of inspiration from that. You referred to earlier in this interview, you know, how, you know, online Indians have become YouTube, you know, the connection. And Balaji Srinivasan has spoke about how he kind of sees Indians as poised to be extremely successful on the English-speaking internet over the next decade. Do you agree with that assessment? Like, what's your take? The kind of context here is Reliance Jio set up, you know, a really powerful but affordable mobile network across most of India here over the last decade or so. That's brought hundreds of millions of people online extremely quickly. So what's your kind of assessment of that prediction and what you're seeing?
Yeah. So one analogy I had, I've thought about this a while back. I actually wrote an article about it. A lot of it is related to English. And one analogy in the past was when the Abbasid Caliphate, you know, this Arabian Caliphate that really spread across the Middle East and towards the Indian subcontinent, into North Africa, it was made up of a lot of different peoples, but primarily, you know, it was Arabic speaking in the core. One way people ascended in that infrastructure of the caliphate was by learning Arabic and, you know, going up the ladder. So you'd see different people, especially like the Indians, the Persians, people in the Levant, Berbers in North Africa. You'd see them learn Arabic, go up in the administration and contribute to the caliphate. This is kind of how the Islamic Golden Age happened, especially in Persia, with a lot of these Persians just using whatever civilizational stuff they already had and translating into Arabic and connecting all these different concepts in different languages. I kind of see that, you know, now with Indians sticking to English and the internet is basically the caliphate. You see more and more Indians learning English. English is a language of ascension, of ascendancy. English medium is like a premium thing. Like if you learn an English medium instead of the local language, you know, you have a lot of access in life. You have a lot of mobility. You have a lot of opportunity. Even local languages in India, you'll notice people speak a lot of times in a pidgin dialect. So, you know, 75% the local language, like Hindi or Gujarati or Punjabi or whatever, and the 25% English. Even people in like small towns and stuff, this is starting to happen. So English is going everywhere in India. And, you know, Hinglish is becoming the lingua franca of, I guess, India's aspirant class, where you see these millennials and Zoomers who really have a different idea of India. They're a lot more confident. They want to make that dent in the world. They want to, you know, they're the ones looking at China being like, hey, we want India to be like this. They're looking at, you know, Silicon Valley and America and thinking, hey, we want India to be like this. We've seen our diaspora succeed. Why can't we do the same? These people all speak in Hinglish, basically, but almost all of them definitely speak in English. And you see Indians kind of going onto the internet, and a lot of people are absorbing ideas, but I actually think that's a bit of a saturation happening, especially amongst elite sections of Indians. One theory I have, and I guess this is again the analogy with the Abbasid Caliphate, where a lot of Persian ideas and a lot of Persian concepts start to spread throughout this Islamic world or the caliphate itself. I think that's going to happen with Indian ideas. So I notice on like tech Twitter, people will make memes about like the Bhagavad Gita and stuff. Or, you know, Sam Altman, he's interested apparently in like the Upanishads and Vedanta, this Indian philosophical stuff, and connects it to AI and things like that. So you see these Indian concepts, whether it's, you know, media, philosophy, even certain parts of religion, or their stories more, I guess, prominently. I think those things are going to start to spread, and the internet might start to Indianize, for better and for worse. So I think there's a lot of culture shock also, which is what you see on the internet when you see the fights between, say, like Indian people and non-Indian people. So it's an interesting time indeed, but I think the most interesting part is that spreading of Indian ideas. So yeah, I think it's going to be good for India.
Yeah. I mean, Balaji tends to be right and early on a lot of stuff. So that was one that definitely got my attention when I saw it, but, I'm interested to see that develop, and I'm really interested to see how, you know, this in particular Trump and Modi kind of bring things together in the years ahead. I'm hopeful that there isn't a flashpoint in, you know, the South China Sea, but what the responses will be to things like that. And Akshar, I hope that at some point in the future we can do this again and build more context for people and analyze what's going on.
Definitely.
For folks that found this valuable, I really want to strongly endorse your YouTube channel, The Emissary, and also the website, theemissary.co. If this felt like, you know, you're dipping your toe into a bunch of information, that is the kind of jumping off point to really build a ton of context around the analysis of India and what's going on in the subcontinent. So Akshar, thank you so much for being on the show. Anything else you want to plug or encourage people to do?
Yeah, definitely follow those. There is one thing I wanted to actually talk to you about.
Okay.
Kind of referencing what we were talking about earlier. You said, what do I think about the future? Your last comment actually made me, it was a light bulb moment. If we could talk about it, I don't know, for sure on time.
Absolutely.
Right, yeah. So I think when it comes to Trump and Modi and the American and Indian relationship, one flashpoint may be, you know, trade or economic relations when it comes to tariffs. I think India is preparing they're preparing a package to, you know, soften that blow already. And I know Modi talked to Trump yesterday or today or something. He's going to visit him soon. I think there's some preemptive action on the economic front, which may hurt India in a way. However, I think my hope is what we see is Modi needs to reform India. Modi needs to do economic reforms and more economic liberalization. A lot of people have been disappointed with him because he hasn't done those things like land reforms, labor reforms, and farm reforms, which he tried to do and he failed at. I think Trump is going to give him a bit more wiggle room. What I mentioned about those, you know, activists and NGO groups and kind of rile up these people to stop those reforms, that was another, you know, tension point when it came to Indian-American relations under the Biden admin. The hope is for a lot of Indians is that Modi has a bit more wiggle room now, and he's going to go for those reforms. If he goes for those reforms, you know, we might be calling Modi Deng Xiaoping, you know, India's Deng Xiaoping, I think, because these are the most consequential reforms India can do. They're the ones that India needs to do to really unleash its economic potential. It's done pretty good so far, but it could really lift off if these reforms happen. But, you know, let's see. There's a lot of domestic stuff too, but I think he has some breathing room here. We might see it.
Yeah, I see similar potential just in terms of the economic upside for India. And it is one of those, it's that tricky thing where, you know, I watch a ton of sports and it's like every game that occurs is like, was that the greatest game ever? Is this the greatest player ever? And people are so captured by the moment that they kind of want to ascribe that to every player in the present. And, you know, you can do the same thing to political history where it's like a lot of these leaders, Emmanuel Macron in France, like that's not someone I think that people will be speaking about at any length 50 years from now. Not completely lost to history, but like is not a seismic figure. Modi, to me, in the same way that Deng was within China, has that potential, particularly if he gets that through. So that is absolutely another piece to be looking for in the years ahead. And, you know, let's lock it down now. If he gets those passed, let's hop on and talk about this again, because that's going to be a really seismic moment.
I'll give you a slight teaser. There's some murmurs. The budget is going to come later this February, and there's some murmurs in Indian media about these things, the land reforms, the labor reforms, and farm reforms. Let's see if it happens. You know, we'll cross our fingers there.
Yeah. Akshay, this has been great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Aaron.
Thanks for listening to the end of my interview with Akshay. If you're interested in more conversations around geopolitics, we have a really good one coming up with Professor Dale Copeland, focused primarily on Taiwan in the context of the US-China rivalry. Or you can listen to our recent conversation with Henry Olson, breaking down Trump and his view and perspective on foreign policy.